Welcome to the Aquarimax Audio Show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 156, recorded March 25th, 2013. Good evening, everyone. Or good morning, depending on when you are listening to this.
Or perhaps good afternoon.
Or how about good brunch or midday snack? Something. Okay. We have some special guests today, as well as some contributors. We'll be hearing from Tony New York and Tom in Provo, and Bob in Boston sent some questions for our budding aquarists here at home. So we are going to have Isaac and Xander and Laurelyn and Gwen all take a few seconds to answer his questions on the podcast.
Let me just say, I think they were very good questions. So
yes, they were.
I will enjoy listening to the responses.
So we'll see what they say. Okay, Gwenny, you want to say hi? You're going to go first. Say hi.
Hi.
So, Gwen, you're kind of a beta expert, aren't you?
Sort of.
Do you have your own beta?
Yes.
And what's his name?
Coral.
How long have you had him?
I forgot.
Since Christmas last year.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
Like, almost a year and a half. Okay. So, Bob's question for you, they're about betas, too. And he says, Gwen, I have two fish tanks. One tank has a female betta in it, and the other one has a male betta in it who is not a gentleman. Should I let them stay together in the same tank? So what do you think? What's your advice?
No.
You think he should separate them?
Yes.
Why not? Why can't they keep them together?
Because then they'll, like, beat up each other, and then female will probably get, like, holes in her fins and...
Get holes in her fins, did you say?
Yes.
Okay, I think that's a pretty good answer. Here's another question for you. If I keep a lot of female bettas together in one tank, will they bonk each other on the mouth?
Maybe.
We have a lot of female bettas together in this tank right here. What happens with them? Are they nice to each other?
Yeah.
Yeah, most of the time, right?
Why are they nice to each other? Why don't they fight?
Because they're not, some of them aren't a boy.
None of them are a boy, in fact.
So all of them are girls until they don't.
Then they don't fight, because we have lots of them in there, so they don't get territorial, huh?
Okay, how about this, Gwen? I think that's a pretty good answer, too.
Yeah.
How do you vacuum your fish tank? Bob says he can't fit his vacuum cleaner in his tank.
How do you get your vacuum cleaner in the fish tank to vacuum the gravel?
You don't. You just get a fish vacuum.
A fish vacuum?
How is that different?
It's a hose.
It's a hose?
What do you do with it?
You put it on the ground, and you suck up the poop.
Okay. Oh. So Bob shouldn't use a real vacuum cleaner, huh?
Yes.
Okay.
All right, very good. Thank you for being on the show, Gwen.
Anything else you want to say before you go?
Yes.
About fish? What?
I like fish!
Okay. Good night, okay. Gwen.
Thank you for coming on the show. Okay, Laurelyn, it's your turn. Well, here are some questions for you.
Okay.
The first question Bob has for you is, did you finally make any money from selling the bettas after all that work?
Yeah, in total we got about $12 each.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
What'd you buy with it?
Paracord and... I don't remember what else. I still have some of the money.
Is that what you got your anklet with?
Oh, yeah! I forgot about that.
You get a jingly anklet?
Yeah.
And some paracord?
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Here's the next one. If I don't change the water in my tanks and leave the fish alone, will they grow faster?
No.
Okay, what did you end up finding out with your study for your science project?
Well, I changed it a couple times, so we ended up doing that. Would if you put a male betta in a jar and a female on one side and another male on the other side, which one would he flare at?
And what did you find was more interesting for the male? Which one did he flare at more?
Flare at the male, which I thought was interesting because the females looked like they had eggs in them.
So you thought he might flare at the females more?
Yeah.
But he ended up flirting the males more?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was more interested in fighting, huh?
Yep.
That's interesting. Okay. And here's the last one that he has for you. If I want my fish to have babies, how many females do I have to put together in one tank?
Just one.
How many females?
You're right. Just one. You don't need any more than that.
What's so funny?
But if you put one female alone in the tank, what do you have to do?
What else do you need?
You have to put a male in, but don't put them right in at the same time, because then they might beat each other up. But sort of introduce them by putting a glass separator and then taking it out gradually.
Okay. Taking it out gradually?
That's kind of what we did when we used that cylinder of glass, isn't it? Okay.
That's
good advice.
Good answer.
Good answers. Okay, thank you, Laurelyn.
Okay, we have Xander next. And he's got some questions for Xander about what he did. He studied beta flaring a little differently than Laurelyn, though. You looked at how close the two different jars with the male betas in them had to be before the betas would flare at each other, yeah? Okay, so Bob wants to know, how do betas light flares underwater?
They use waterproof flares.
Ah! Okay, how close do the male betas have to be to flare at each other?
From 5 inches away, which is usually not noticeable, but if they do, they start making angry faces at each other. But if they're closer, say their jars are touching, they get out their shotguns and start bursting their shirts.
They turn into the Hulk?
Okay, so the closer they get, the more often they flare, but 5 inches usually wasn't enough, and jar touching was? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay, that sounds good. Thank you.
Okay, and this is our oldest,
How
Isaac.
Is it going to be with you?
Hopefully it's going to be well.
That is what I'm hoping to be also.
Isaac, how old are you?
13.
13. 20. And he's taller. Five. He's taller than me already. Hard there, but that's
five,
okay.
6 and a half.
Yeah. Okay, so Bob's question for you, Isaac, is can you give me a mathematical equation for string theory?
Actually, yes.
Go ahead.
42.
And if you get that, then leave us a comment on the Facebook page, and we'll put you in the cool people club.
Yeah. And then we'll dip you in the mashed potatoes.
Okay, and if you
well,
get that
no,
one...
Well, no mashed potatoes.
Okay. All right, so we have another one for you, too. Please just give us some of your results that you discovered from your science project.
Okay. There were the...
What was your project on again?
It was on genetics, predicting the genetics of the fry based on the phenotypes of the parents.
Okay.
The visible traits, anyway. There were some invisible ones that were probably from the grandparents or earlier that showed up in the fry that we hadn't expected. Like, some of them had different colored eyes and black gills and blue lips and gold flecks all over, and there was some pretty interesting stuff going on there.
Okay.
And in terms of some of the traits that you were predicting that you would find, what are some of those and how did they turn out?
Well, there were different fin patterns. There were crown tail and delta, super delta, half moon. Half moon wasn't one that we predicted, but crown tail was half there and half off.
And what do you call that? Do you remember?
The word just flew out of my head.
It's
I had
income.
Incomplete?
Codominance.
Incomplete.
It's well, there's codominance and incomplete.
Like, I can't talk right now.
That's okay.
So they had, like, not a crown tail, but, like, a comb tail.
Yeah, it was like a kind of serrated, but more longer spines than it would have been if it was just serrated. So there was some crown tail in there, but...
But never complete, as complete as it expressed as it would be in...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, personally, I like better.
Homozygous crown tail. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what about, what was some of the, so you found that the males, anything about the finnage you noticed with the males?
They expressed the long fin. They all of the fry were long fin, as far as we could tell. But the males expressed it and the females didn't.
Yeah, females tend not to. Right. And what about coloration? What did we predict coloration-wise and what did we actually get?
We predicted that most of them would be more butterfly, and there would be a couple Cambodias, but it turned out that there would actually be about half and half.
With a few outliers in there.
Yeah.
Turned out really funky.
Bizarre.
Some
did
marbles.
We get any paisley?
We got marbles, though, didn't we? We didn't get any paisley.
Somebody should come up with a paisley beta.
That would be interesting.
Limburger beta.
Mm.
Yeah, Laurelin wants to remind us that we got some blushing betas.
That's true.
The red opercular or gill covers. So, yeah, we got all kinds of interesting things, but most of them were either butterfly or Cambodia. True. And you kind of predicted that, didn't you?
Yeah. I predicted like 75% butterfly.
Mm-hmm. And we got closer to 50-50.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right, well, anything else you'd like to add?
Think really
hard. If you have bananas, eat them. And eat them now.
Okay. Thank you.
That's the wise words of advice from Isaac. So.
Okay, thank you for joining us this evening, Isaac.
Welcome.
And thank you to all the kids for joining us once again.
And for the groovy questions from Bob.
Yeah.
Alrighty. The kids are now off to bed. So we will finish the rest of the podcast.
Indeed.
And we're going to go to Tom in Provo.
Okay. You know, he mentioned he wants a t-shirt.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, but he said he doesn't want one that has a depiction of live food as the picture.
I think that's wise. I don't think anybody wants, like, squirmy microworms on their t-shirt.
Most people probably do not, although I must admit I have had squirmy microworms on my t-shirt before. But by
accident. But not a picture of them.
Right. Just
it was the real, actual squirmy microworms.
Spilled them, yes.
Which is
disgusting.
Very much better, yeah.
So, yes, we will attempt.
We promise it won't be live food on the t-shirt.
Right. We actually have a couple of ideas of what's going to be on the t-shirt, and none of them involve live food.
I like your idea about the surface area song.
Yeah, so we're going to see if we can do that. Mm-hmm. Cool. So.
Alrighty. So he says, how about a short primer on micro-resboras? I've heard the term a number of times, but when I Google it, there seems to be conflicting information. What species are included? Are celestial pearl danios in this taxon? And he put in a little note here, which I laughed heartily at, and I appreciate much. He says, at this point, Kelly should feel free to wax eloquent about the shortcomings of taxonomy as a science.
Okay, you want to go ahead and do that for a minute?
No, that's okay. I think that kind of much sums it up.
Okay. Well, this is my understanding. I was trying to do a little research on this because I am not an expert on microresboras, but from what I can understand looking at FishBase and some other sources, FishBase, you know, is a good source to go to. Hopefully I'll keep this straight in my head because I'm not actually looking at FishBase right now. So what I believe is Microresbora is a genus that of a very tiny resboras, but they're not really taxonomically as related to resboras as they are to danios.
They're more like a danio, but people call them resboras.
Yes.
Do they look cosmetically more like a resbora?
Well,
and that's why? Or
They're all related to some extent.
So like danios and resboras are kind of cousins-ish?
Yes, they're related. But the idea is, I guess, that celestial pearl danios were once put into that genus.
Into the micro resbora?
They've been in like three genera as far as I know. They've been in, Celestichthys, their own genus, the celestial fish, right, genus,
okay.
Microresbora, and Danio.
And what do they have them others. In currently?
They're in Danio right now. They're Danio margaritatus, which is the pearled Danio. It used to be the pearled celestial fish.
So why do they keep switching them around? They just haven't found out that much about them yet?
They're trying to see where they fit the best. And they've also been in microresbora. And there are a couple of other fish in Microresbora, but the taxon Microresbora is a little bit under, let's see, it's...
Under construction?
Under construction, sure, under review. There are a couple of species in there, depending on who you talk to. There might be two, there might be three, nobody's really sure. But I think in the hobby...
That waxes eloquent enough, you know, I don't have to say anything.
Yeah. Well, I think in the hobby, though, the deal is that Microresbora is often used to refer to several different small species of cyprinid fish that could include also the genus Boratus, which was a genus that they kind of made up because they're kind of like resboras, but they're not exactly, and they're also teeny.
Maybe it's kind of like teacup dog breeds now. They should just make up the own, you know, it's like a common name for teacup They're just throw them all in the micro-resboras because they're tiny and they're cute, but you can't keep them in a teacup,
well,
really.
See, that's sort of what has happened in a sense, because they, in a popular sense, if you're talking about mm-hmm. micro-resboras, people might be talking about the genus micro-resbora,
right.
They might be talking about Boraris, or they might be talking about some
it's
of the small
pretty
Danios.
And delicate and little, so we'll call them all micro-resboras.
Yeah, and I think there's even another
idea?
Genus. It's I can't remember it now. It's something like Microdivario or something like that. It's also another Danio-like
mm-hmm.
tiny one. But the basic idea is they're all really small, and they so they're good occupants for nanotanks because they're so small. And that's there are several species out there. I know the only one I've kept of any of those fish that might be considered in the non-taxonomic but popular sense of micro-resbora would be the Celestial Pearl Danio.
Mm-hmm.
And I've kept them and I've bred them.
They were pretty.
And they are very pretty. Unfortunately, when we talked about the attack of the mycobacteriosis, they proved to be very susceptible to it.
Mm-hmm.
So they all succumbed to that eventually. But that was after, you know, we had had a couple of successful spawns. They grew up and did fine for a while, but then they just started suffering from the mycobacteriosis and then that outbreak. So
I guess that makes sense then with conflicting information on different websites, depending on, you know, what source, what year the website got its information from, that would maybe be why they were listed in different...
Right, and who agrees with whom about the mm-hmm. taxonomic mess, sort of, so to speak. I wish I could be more clear on that, but I think I would find that difficult. But a few things to think about.
So basically it depends on who you ask.
Different fish respond to different water conditions. A lot of them prefer kind of soft acid water.
Mm-hmm.
I know the Celestial Pearl Danios did fine in our tap water here. Without
we
modification.
We have pretty hard water.
We do. And they naturally actually are, they come from somewhat more alkaline waters than some of the other micro-resboras do. And so they do just fine. And they spawned in this water. There was no modification of the water and they spawned it in the, you know, they grew up in it and it was fine. Some of the others, I believe, do better if they have some RO water as part of their mixture. But I couldn't say a whole lot because I haven't really kept them. I do know that our local fish store stocks some of them. I think it's Boraris maculatus, or is it maculata? I can't remember. But anyway, they stock that one fairly regularly, and I've seen some of the other.
Probably a lot of local fish stores do. He's asking about how readily available are they. Like
yeah.
He shouldn't have to go online or anything to get
them.
Well,
because he lives close enough, if he wanted to, he could come up here and get some.
Oh, that's true.
That's
you're in Provo,
saying.
I forgot. Yeah,
so
he can come
fish,
up, fish
for
you.
Does stock at least one or mm-hmm. two species. They do stock Celestial Pearl Danios, and a lot of other pet stores
mm-hmm.
do too. So if he's interested in either of those two species, he could at least get those fish for you.
Okay.
Which doesn't really apply to a lot of our other listeners, but there you go.
It's helpful for Tom.
Yep. And but the other information about them hopefully will.
Right. He wanted also to know if you would recommend them for a new aquarist or not.
Not so much.
A little bit, because they're a little bit picky.
A little bit picky. Let me just give an example with Celestial Pearl Danios. Okay, the ones I originally got, the original stock, was wild caught, as
mm-hmm.
far as I was able to tell. They were extremely picky. They wouldn't touch pelleted food. Or
you don't get that in the wild. What the heck is that?
Well, I shouldn't say they wouldn't touch it. They would grab onto it, mouth it for a minute, spit it out, and they wouldn't really eat it. I had to give them brine shrimp, microworms. What else did I give them? Daphnia.
Which might be tricky things for a brand new aquarist to...
Right. And so unless you're into live foods, the wild-caught ones are not such good candidates. But the second generation, they
mm-hmm.
were fine. They would eat anything.
They would eat it fine.
They ate anything I gave
That's
them.
That's interesting.
Because they had been raised on it. I raised
right.
them on... after they got off of Cyclops, Nauplia, and microworms, I gave them golden pearls. And then after that, I could give them anything I wanted, and they would eat it. So
okay.
That's one reason why I would say I would hesitate to suggest them to a new aquarist is that most of them, to my understanding, not limiting myself to the Celestial Pearl Danios, but most of them do better with large amounts of live food in the diet and may, in fact, fail to thrive if they're not given mostly live food.
Okay.
That's my understanding. So.
Alrighty. So not so much for a beginner.
Right.
He has a little non-pod... cast-related note, or at least non-fish-related note, which I very much appreciated. Again, I thought it was very funny.
So did I. So I think we can go ahead.
Yes. He says, I was listening to old podcasts and I ran across your list of movies and was really pleased that The Russians Are Coming was there. A neglected classic, by which I mean favorite of mine. The scene with Carl Reiner and the telephone operator trying to descend the stairs while tied together may be one of the funniest bits of physical comedy I've ever seen. That's a very good part. And he says, I will sign off by saying, emergency, everybody to get from street.
Which is a quote you'll hear fairly often around our house.
Yes.
Thank you.
So,
well appreciated.
If you haven't ever seen The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming, go watch it, because it's hilarious.
Okay.
We haven't taken a break yet.
Oh, maybe we should.
Let's take a break.
Hello, this is Ken Jones of the Prince of Pawns and Pet Tech Podcasts, and you're listening to one of my favorites, The Aquarimax Show.
Now there are more ways than ever to be a part of Aquarimax. In addition to downloading the podcast on iTunes, you can follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or call us anytime and leave a phone message at 801-477-0629, or just email us at info@aquarimax.com. And now, back to the Aquarimax Audio Show, the podcast with Icy Nine.
All right, we have a little treat today. You all know we interviewed Diana Wahlstad a few weeks ago about her book, The Ecology of the Planted Tank. And Tony from New York has done a book review on it, an audiobook review, that he sent to us to put up on the show to give us more kind of a reader's perspective on the book.
Right, so we're going to go ahead and, without further ado, allow Tony to take the floor.
Or the microphone. Or the airwaves. Take it, Tony.
Contributor Corner, Contributor Corner. Hello, it's Tony from New York. I am here to talk to you today about Ecology of the Planted Aquarium by Diana Wahlstad. As of 2013, this book is in the third edition. I'd like to tell you a little bit about it for the Aquarimax podcast. First, I'll give you a few of my initial impressions on this book. I'm holding it right now, and I can tell you this, it's a nice, solid, hefty, hardback book. Roughly 200 pages of material. I do have to tell you, not a lot in the way of pictures. What's there is mostly black and white, although there are a few stunning color plates near the beginning of the book. And these ones are awfully nice because they show you quite a bit of what's possible for your own planted aquarium. The book has a little bit of space that describes the natural low-tech aquarium, and it does give guidelines and other information for its successful setup. But the bulk of the book focuses on discussing important aquarium ecology topics in somewhat heavy scientific detail. The book has charts, data, and there are references for each chapter. Now, although the level of scientific detail can seem daunting at first, the author does take the time to sufficiently explain and explore topics so that the dedicated reader can improve his or her appreciation and understanding of these topics. The point of much scientific discussion is for the purpose of supporting a case for the planted aquarium, but also serves to dispel a number of commonly held but incorrect assumptions in the aquarium hobby today. To me, this is especially where this book surpasses all others, with its careful examination of the subject matter and its rigorous support of the claims it makes. For example, it is commonly believed that safe drinking water is also safe for aquarium water once it's dechlorinated, but this is not always the case. In her chapter on plants as water purifiers, Diana debunks this claim, describing fish symptoms of metal poisoning, and describing how plants can mitigate the risks. Planted aquarium enthusiasts will find this book to be invaluable. The Wahlstad method focuses on the low-tech aquarium, which uses soil, as a major carbon and nutrient source, which may be different than what some people are used to, but does address many topics of universal interest as well, such as controlling algae, providing correct light, plant versus plant competition, or allelopathy, the role of bacteria in the aquarium and in the soil, carbon and plant strategies, carbon and plant strategies for its uptake, soil and substrate discussion, including a section on selection and setup, and the advantage of plants that utilize atmospheric CO2. Conventional wisdom advises us to take special care to establish a biofilter for an aquarium as a way of ensuring a healthy environment. Diana takes us to the next level by first working to improve our appreciation for plants as purifiers, and then by demonstrating that we build a strong foundation for a healthy aquarium when we focus on the needs of plants first. I especially enjoyed the last chapter, which provides guidelines for setting up a low-tech planted tank. In addition to the overview of recommended fish and plants, the chapter goes on to explain recommended lighting and has a description of the siesta regimen. This is new to the third edition, I believe. In the author's words, the siesta regimen gives plants the long day length they need and saves electricity. Finally, it reduces algae's afternoon advantage over plants. The Ecology of the Planted Aquarium is less a book that you would read cover to cover, but works instead best as a reference work. And it very much has an academic feel, a lot like a textbook. Smartly, it includes a comprehensive index and an intuitive organization of material, which makes locating a topic when you need it very easy. In summary, I recommend this book to all non-beginners and advanced hobbyists, pond and aquarium hobbyists alike, who could best appreciate the depth that Ecology of the Planted Aquarium delivers. Others who would appreciate it would be any and all plant aquarium enthusiasts and any science-minded aquarists. And of course, it is absolutely required reading for those who are interested in pursuing the Wallstad method or any other low-tech planted tank endeavors.
Wow.
That was a great review.
That was really great.
It was insightful. Thorough.
Ooh, yeah. Jinx. Yeah. You have to buy me ice cream.
Okay. Yeah, there's not a lot I can say about it, except that was great.
That was really good. You should be a book reviewer, Tony.
There you go. I agree.
So that was awesome. Thank you for sharing.
Indeed. Thank you very much. And I think just to let the listeners say for that, just say,
may the fish be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.